We are going to be joined by our esteemed guest who led the largest longitudinal study on the continent following the lives of 3,000 children born in the year 1990. That's way after my time. And we're going to find out what the aim of the study is because it has now formed part of a new published book that gives insight to five major themes when it comes to child development in South Africa. Our guest, Professor Linda Rechter, who's the developmental psychologist and distinguished professor in the Center of Excellence in Human Development at the University of Witwatersrand, is joining us via Zoom. Thank you very much for giving us your time, Professor Rechter. Good morning.
Good morning, Patricia. Thanks for asking me. It's a pleasure to be able to talk to you and to be able to talk to people listening to the program.
So being able to collect data from 3,000 children born in South Africa in the year 1990, how complicated was that? And also, tell us about the demographics of the 3,000 children.
Sure. The subtitle of the book is A Study as Ambitious as the Country We Wanted to Create. So that gives you an idea of it was complicated. It was actually a study restricted into a particular area, which was Soweto, Johannesburg, and to a particular time period, the 23rd of March to the 8th of June, 1990. Now, that is the way you define a cohort, a birth cohort. It's a way of circumscribing who you get to enroll. So we enrolled every single child who was born during that period in the then boundaries of Soweto, Johannesburg. It was very complicated because these were three different municipal authorities, Diepmeer, Soweto, and Johannesburg. They all had their own ways of registering births and so on. The birth notifications were written out by people who didn't speak the language of the people they were noting. So that, for example, a woman whose name was Charlie, T-J-A-L-I, got recorded as Charlie, C-H-A-R-L-I-E. So it took an enormous amount of time to sort out who was born in that area at the time. And at the time, it was geographically, it was demographically representative of the population. So the majority of people were Black African, then so-called coloreds, so-called Indians, and then whites. Over time, though, there were actually 3,273 births, all singletons, no twins or triplets. We only wanted to study singletons because multiple births have somewhat different trajectories to singleton births. Over time, we saw white children dropping out of the study for lots of reasons. The one was their parents were much more mobile, leaving the city or leaving areas, not leaving the country, not wanting to participate in something like this, just as they are reluctant to participate in household surveys, people who knock on their doors and so on. On the other hand, everybody else saw great value in participating in the study because we were situated in the grounds of Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital. People saw that this may be a way of getting better services, of at least having people check your child annually or twice yearly, as we were doing in the teenage years. So by the time we finished at this 30-year age point, we are in contact with about 2,000 of those young people, which is amazing retention if you think of the mobility of people in the most dense urban area of South Africa.
Professor Rechter, as you are telling us about the demographics and how a majority of the white participants dropped out due to reasons that you have noted, does that not then tell you something about this cohort of young people who were born in the year 1990, this Kadesa generation, this Madiba generation? Does it not inform us that, well, there is influence from the generation that is pre Kadesa generation, pre-Nelson Mandela generation, their parents, their guardians, informing the decisions that they end up making in participating holistically in the country?
Absolutely. In fact, one of the biggest findings of the study is that history matters. So, and we talk about that in terms of history matters from an individual point of view, but history matters as for the group. So if I talk about history matters for the individual We talk about their own particular generational history, the health and the well-being of their families, the socioeconomic circumstances in which they grew up, tend to cast a long shadow or a long beam of light into their lives as they grow up. So, for example of that is if a girl is overweight in childhood, she's 40 times more likely to be obese as a woman. On the other hand, if a child is born to a mother who is depressed, the child is much more likely to have some psychological struggles in adolescence, and those tend to persist into adulthood. So history matters for the individual, but history also matters for the group. So that, for example, if we look at growth of these children, the growth of Black African children has definitely improved, but it is still quite significantly below the growth of white children. So the history of the legacy of the past is very much present amongst these groups, both, as I say, individually and as a group. On the other hand, if we look at another aspect of growth, which is when does puberty start for girls, that's when they have their first menses, that has dropped almost a year in the 30 years of the study. So that we're now seeing girls of 12.4 age are now starting their menses compared to 13.1 in their mother's generation. They're also taller than their mothers. They're about a centimeter taller. That means they have been exposed to better socioeconomic and nutritional circumstances than their mother. So history is just everything in the study, and that is what has been the core of the science, and that is studying this individual change over time that you can link to the past, and then studying the secular change, that is the change in the entire group as they grow older.
So there's this remarkable changes in the different generations, and obviously we want this generation and the study to bring forth that which is going to bring a change for us as South Africans. So in the study, there are some pillars that you looked at, or some five main themes that you looked at. Maybe take us through these and how they've impacted on the study and with the thinking of these young people, who some are now parents themselves.
Sure. And in fact, just on Thursday last week, I was noted, we refer in terminology to G1 or Generation 1 are the mothers who were pregnant in 1990. G2 are the children who were born in 1990. G3 are their children. And in fact, we already have G4. And I was notified on Thursday that one of the G4 children is 13 years old and pregnant. So we really go on this long history. But we intended from the very beginning to study the impact of very rapid urbanization on health and development in children. So we all know what was happening in the late 80s. I mean, South Africa was in an absolute turmoil of violence and political strife. But also what was happening is that there was what I call a demographic reckoning. The apartheid state had classified Black people as non-South Africans, as being citizens of Bantustans, and the independent states and white people were citizens of South Africa. And once the influx control and other controls were starting to fall away in the late 80s, and the resistance was growing, the calls for Mandela to be released were growing, the nationalist government must have sat down and said, well, one of the things that's going to happen is there's going to be massive urbanization, because the Bantustans and the independent states were relatively rural, whereas the urban, you know, white people were living largely in urban areas. So what was going to happen is there was going to be massive urbanization. So that's a demographic shift. And with that demographic shift was going to be nutritional shift. People would stop eating traditional foods and would start to eat more urban-based fast foods. There would be a health shift, so that with better health facilities, even though they were overwhelmed by the urbanization drive, better health facilities would lead to lower infant infectious diseases, but you would see smoking, alcohol, obesity, long-term infections like HIV and tuberculosis were rising. So the main aim of
Can I go to a quick break? I'd like you to just hold it there and we'll be back so you can tell us more about the main aim.
Hashtag SAFM Talking Point. Patricia Nduli on SAFM.
Remember that you can join in on this conversation. Ask your questions or what are your thoughts about this new generation that is now adults, born the year 1990. They are called the Kadesa generation. They are called the Madiba generation. Is this a generation that you're seeing participating well in our socioeconomic development and a generation that can possibly and potentially bring the change that is needed in our country? Our guest is Professor Linda Rechter, who is talking to us about a study that they have conducted over the lives of 3,000 children in South Africa, born in the year 1990, who some are even grandparents now. Sure, funny to think of it that way. I don't have a grandchild as yet, so it's far for me to fathom. But yeah, this generation is a generation that has really, seen a different light than what we saw born in the 80s. Professor Rechter, before we went to the break, you were just telling us the aims of, part of the study, especially in the light of urbanization.
Right. So initially, Patricia, we weren't as ambitious as we became. We wanted to study the children to 10 years of age. That would cover the period of sort of major mortality of young children into the kind of period of risk for injuries and accidents and so on. But we became more ambitious because we managed to interest funders in the study, and they allowed us to expand to birth to 20 and now birth to 30, and we are in the process of expanding to birth to 40. Now, at the time, we had quite a narrow conception. We wanted to look at health and wellness and psychological development of these children. As we've expanded up to birth to 30, we've expanded our ambitions to look at health and mental health, education, economic participation, and social engagement. And the data we collected over this time, I mean, it's more than 22 million variables we've collected, an enormous amount of data, because we've seen these people every year. We've measured every aspect of them, taken blood, delivered lots of questionnaires and so on, and tests of cognitive development and so on. We have really kind of seen that we've got sort of results in the field of violence, of learning and education, physical growth or healthy growth, mental and social well-being and social engagement. And so those form the five scientific parts of the study, of the book. The earlier chapters deal with how did it all work? Such a huge study. What were the people like? Where did they live? And so on. And the last two chapters, I reflect on what we had learned and that it was always more than a study. So I'm desperately hoping that there will be some birth to 30 participants listening. We recently launched the book in Soweto, the Jabalani Community Center, where every participant received a free copy of the book, courtesy of the Oppenheimer Memorial Trust. And I was overjoyed because so many of them wanted their book signed. They saw it as really a kind of story of their lives, that even though we were serving Kentucky Streetwise 3 for lunch, the signing queue was longer than the food queue, and it just warmed my heart enormously.
Now, looking at the five themes, back to them, the issue of violence. So before this generation, there was a different sort of violence based on apartheid. It was a violence that was national, that was big, And now we've got violence that is sometimes within just the home, within just the society, the feeling of not being safe. Gender-based violence is now rife. It's no longer huge mass protests and gun shootings that are impacting the entire community, but it's at a closed level. So what has the study showed us about their outlook as children born in the year 1990 when it comes to violence?
Right. I mean, Patricia, you correctly sketched the background of the national level violence of protest and oppression that lasted a good 5 to 8 years, in which everybody, it was violence was everywhere and people all people were afraid. It wasn't as if, you know, anybody was exempt. Everybody was afraid of this uncontrolled violence, a bit like what we saw in the riots in Durban. I actually live in Durban. It's terribly frightening. We have to ask ourselves how much of the violence we now experience was enabled by that. So now we see violence, as you said, every single level, interpersonal violence, really quite unprecedented levels of interpersonal violence, violence in the home, violence in schools, violence in communities, criminal violence. So we, over the whole period of the study, we asked young people whether they experienced violence, whether they witnessed violence, they just saw it, but they didn't experience it, and whether they perpetrated violence. And before the age of 18, only 1% of children had not experienced violence, witnessed violence, or perpetrated violence. And about a third of children had experienced them in every setting. So our levels of violence are really extraordinarily high. The other thing is when we put questions to young people at age 28 about interpersonal violence, what was unusual and surprising to me is that both men and women both experienced violence in the interpersonal relationships and perpetrated them. Now, obviously, so that it's not as if, you know, women are somehow equal in this, because a woman will always come out worse than a man from a violent encounter, and women are often dependent on men. So if men are violent towards them, it actually destroys, you know, not only their self-esteem, their physical damage and so on, but also probably takes their livelihoods away. But if we see some very strange patterns, we see developmental patterns. So all children, as a matter of developmental progression, become fairly oppositional when they are 2 and 3, you know, the old saying about terrible twos. So they're wanting to become independent, and so they say no, and they do it opposite of what they're told. And we see quite a lot of physical punishment of young children in the home, perpetrated by women often because they're in home. Then you see a decline in violence once children enter preschool and school, where there's quite a lot of emphasis on socialization and getting on with other children and so on. And then we see a surging again, particularly when children get into secondary school. And actually the highest levels of violence that happen, both experienced, witnessed, and perpetrated, are when young people are about 17 years of age. Now, we have to work out what gives rise to that that peak of violence at that point.
All right. Can we hold it there just for a few seconds? We need to go to the news headlines, Prof. We'll be back after this. Luyanda, thank you for your patience. It's a minute after 10:30.
Hashtag SAFM Talking Point. Patricia Nduli on SAFM.
We're still in discussion with Professor Linda Rechter of the University of Witwatersrand, tackling the article and book that she contributed to, Birth at 2:30, The Progress of the Kodesa Generation. Now, before the news headlines, Prof, you were talking to us about violence and the outlook of this cohort of young people. Professor Rechter, are you still there?
I'm sorry, I've muted myself.
Okay.
I was talking about this peak in violence around the age of 17, and we've really puzzled about what that might be due to. Now, one of the things is when children attend primary schools, they very often attend primary schools within their neighborhood, and so often are in class with children from around their own home. They have a home teacher, so there's a very different environment to when children go into secondary school. Many children have to take taxis or buses or trains to get to secondary school. And that means they are in places like taxi ranks, train stations, and so on, where a fair amount of violence is witnessed. Like, one participant described to me how he saw an old woman being shambucked into a taxi, for example. So one reason is that young people are ranging over further into communities and therefore are witnessing more violence. The second thing is that that's a kind of peak teenage year, that it's when young people begin to feel their own autonomy. begin to have confidence in their group identity and might become a little bit more challenging to other people, and so might experience a bit of pushback, and which may involve violence as well. And the third reason is that we know that there's a hypersensitivity amongst that age of group of children to slights and insults and such, you know, self-offensive behavior. So that, for example, more young people report bad things happening in their lives around that age than remember them later in life. So if we ask them, looking back, what happened when you were at that age, they don't remember things that they reported when they were that age. So it's a very intriguing phenomenon about this peaking. After that peak, there tends to be a decline in violence, except amongst a subgroup of people who seem to adopt violent behavior as part of their problem-solving interpersonal strategies and so on.
I've got a voice note here from one of our A-team listeners. Let's go to it.
Well, Patricia, and our lovely psychologist. The question I would like to pose to her is, do the political activities and bloodshed that occurred during the Cordesa period, did they impact negatively on mental development of the kids who were born then? That's the question. The second question is, do such the kids who were born during the Madiba era, do they inactively participate in economic growth, or do they not contribute to economic growth at all? Khausen from Mel Park. Good morning, lovely people.
Thank you, Khausen, for that those questions, Prof.
Sure. Yes, we in fact have looked specifically at whether the very high levels of stress that people experience as a result of the violence. You know, I experienced it myself driving to Baragwanath Hospital. I would see these huge Caspers rolling in the streets, and it must have been absolutely terrifying to be a pregnant woman having to go to a clinic amidst this kind of random war zone. And yes, we have followed that up, and we do have evidence, it's associational evidence, that level of stress experienced by people during that period of their lives, that is during their antenatal when they were pregnancy and their children's early years, seems to have left a mark in terms of signs of traumatic psychological distress. So yes, we do think it's very hard to pin down. 30 years of somebody's life is a very long time. Lots of things happen. People whose lives turn out better tend to think differently about their past than people whose lives turn out badly. But it's definitely our position, and we have published a scientific paper on this, that that trauma was what left a mark. So yes, that I agree with that. The second question was about, are they participating economically? Mm. Well, as you know, only about 55% of young people who start school actually matriculate. And we find the same thing in our study, that it's an absolute disgrace that 45% of people just probably don't have a shot at the formal economy because they don't even have a matric certificate.
Once again, Professor, I'm going to ask you, can you break that down? That 45% that does not have a shot,
yeah.
Is it from the Black, Coloured and Indian community as opposed to majority also coming from the white community?
No, this is very largely Black and Coloured.
So clearly the predisposition of our history is still playing a role for these young people who were born in the year 1990, these children of Madiba.
Absolutely. I'll come back to that. Mm. But just to say that despite not matriculating, 70% of the people in the study are participating economically in one way or another. At least 20% in temporary type, the Uber kind of work, but 50% seem to have a job in which an employment contract is involved and so on. But absolutely, Patricia, our history, that's why I said history is everything in this study. You know, poor families send their children to poorer quality schools and struggle more during their school years. What we also find, though, is that you can draw those influences back from the school into the home. So one of the interesting analyses we did was to look at where children's household socioeconomic circumstances, particularly whether their parents, what their parents' education was, and the neighborhood socioeconomic levels, really looking at the constellation of people who had assets like fridges and motor cars and TV sets and mobile phones and so on. And we find that the household socioeconomic level, particularly parent education, is a stronger determinant of educational success. So it's a combination of things. Things that are in the environment, like the quality of schools, and things that are in the home. But in every way, boys are much worse off. Many more girls matriculate than boys do. And I think we have to have a big conversation in this country about what happens to boys in school. And this has become a worldwide trend, in fact, that more girls are staying in school, are achieving in school, finishing, getting into university, finishing their degrees sooner and so on. So it's a complicated question, yeah.
So clearly, this question is going to overlap into the one around poverty and employment and inequality. We know that South Africa, according to the Gini coefficient, is the most unequal country in the world. Clearly, poverty plays a role in this. Unemployment plays a role in this. Let's talk about the impacts and the findings of the study around these.
Well, that's true. All of that, of course, permeates people's lives. And we've tracked it, as I said before, on an individual level and on a group level. So we track it right back to the mother and father's education and their socioeconomic circumstances. They work their way into mother's height so that poorer women are shorter. They tend to have smaller babies. Those babies grow less well. Babies who grow less well do less well at school. This is on average. I'm not talking about an individual person whose mother was short or whatever. I'm talking about the averages. And so we see this perpetuated so that you can actually find a relationship between birth weight and who matriculates and who doesn't. So these things are embedded both biologically and psychologically. And parental education is a critical part of that. So not only the biological history of the mother and father, how much nutrition they had in their families, how much influence they had from people who had perspectives that had been enlarged by education, but psychologically that works its way through. And so we can't, although things have improved, so I said women today are a centimeter taller than their mothers, many more have achieved matriculation compared to their mothers. Things have improved, but they have not improved nearly enough, and the gap between the rich and the poor are not, is increasing in our view in this generation.
Sure. And you know, when we speak of the inequality, especially in the education sector, I mean, has your study grabbed the attention for learning and education, especially at early childhood development phase? Has it grabbed the attention of the Department of Education, the Department of Social Development, so that your study and the findings can inform the work that is being done in these departments?
Well, certainly it has, Patricia. And this is going back even to the early days of the study. The findings from the study really brought it home to South African decision makers of the importance of what is called the first 1,000 days. That's the pregnancy of 270 days and the subsequent year of 365 and the next year of 365. We call it the very critical first 1,000 days of life. Because the study, together with four other birth cohort studies in other developing countries, is absolutely unequivocal in showing that what happens in those first 2 years of life affects schooling and affects health and wellness. So that, for example, the definition of stunting is children who are more than 2 standard deviations below the mean of their peers, the same age, same gender, sex of the growth. Children who are below that score on average 1 less grade of schooling. Now, there has been a lot of interest in this, and of course it came out in the first National Development Plan that we needed to think about the first 1,000 days in health, and that we had to get more serious about early childhood development in education. And it was that the proposal was made that we should have a second year of pre-primary. I, in fact, was one of the people who did the researching and drafting of the National Integrated Early Child Development Policy. And those principles were incorporated, and many of them were informed by the findings of the study. And it unfortunately, COVID and a lot of other things have distracted us from these goals, but looked like we're very much on track now. Department of Education has really grabbed this problem by the neck, and we will shortly, and hopefully in the next year, we will see grade R becoming compulsory. It is already universal, and we will see the introduction of the second grade R year, which will mean that from 3.5, children will be able to enter into a preschool program, government funded and free. And the other thing was, last week I attended a meeting of the National Planning Committee in Cape Town, at which the whole idea of the first 1,000 days was revitalized. And in fact, Department of Health has picked this up with a great deal of enthusiasm and has revised their road to health card, concentrating on the first 1,000 days, concentrating on the importance of nurturing care and of nutrition, and has now got what is called the side-by-side campaign, in which it likens the healthcare provider's relationship with the mother to the mother's relationship with the child, that these two relationships have to be ones of care and protection and promotion in order for a child to develop. So, you know, as a person who's been in this field, the early child development field, for all of my career, I'm heartened by that we're getting back on track in this field now.
And I'm very heartwarmed by the development that your research has done. I'm always worried about children. There's a question here on WhatsApp from one of our listeners around the generational gap. Let's go to it.
Morning, Patricia. It's a luck from God to have children that listen. Otherwise, whether it's your child is from urban rural areas or is a church goer, it's a luck from God. They don't listen. And I advise parents, especially mothers, to inspect their little ones, because you find that they menstruate early because they are raped by relatives, neighbors, and also the technology is showing them sex and these books, and the teachers there outside, they will tell them how to do sex. So there's no future. Let us pray. Thank you, Patricia. Lisedi.
Thank you very much for that question. It's a very poignant question. I mean, the generational gap when it comes to communication, Prof, is one that we should talk about. Earlier, you did mention that in the study, you've noticed that even there's now a G2, G3, G4. So a 13-year-old who is from the study, who is now pregnant, you know. So there's different generations within this CODESA generation. There's now grandparents, parent and child. So how do we bridge that gap of communication? But also take it a step further. How do we bridge it within our own communities, within community stakeholders, from you know, the teachers in the education sector to police, to policing forums, to social workers, to everyone who's involved intrinsically in a community?
It's an interesting question. You know, we've had a 13-year-old mother in each of the generations, G1, G2, G3, and now in G4.
It speaks a lot. It speaks volumes about what's happening when it comes to sex, as the voice note stated.
Right. And so when we had the first G2 13-year-old pregnancy, I was very intrigued about it, why, what the circumstances were. And so we had one of our long-term interviewers go and visit the young woman and visit her mother separately to talk about it and just try and understand what it was about. This young girl was at a school in Soweto. Soweto is the most urbanized part of South Africa. There was, in fact, a school, a designated school counselor at the school. There was a nearby clinic that claimed to be youth friendly. Whether it was or not, we couldn't ascertain. And so despite all this, she became pregnant, that meaning she didn't have access to contraception or the information to protect herself, but she also didn't talk to anybody, so she didn't get any antenatal care until she had her baby. She tried to hide it. When we spoke to the mother, who was heartbroken about this because she could barely support her child, let alone a grandchild at this point, trying to understand you know, what the circumstances were, she said something that really I've reflected on a lot since then, and that is, she said, I could see she was pregnant, but I didn't say anything because then it would become my problem. I would have to do something about it. And so there was the silence, which must have been absolutely unbearable for both the mother and daughter. And there is definitely a huge communication problem, a problem of being able to talk it out and feel trusting that one won't be punished, rejected, but somebody will help one with the problem. On the other hand, we started testing this cohort for HIV at age 13. Now, to do that, we had to provide a lot of ethical safeguards, including providing health care for these young people should they be HIV positive or pregnant or have an STD or whatever. One of the safeguards was that they would only be tested if they gave consent, and they gave consent to have an adult be with them should they be positive when we disclose their results to them, and who that adult would be. And in fact, almost 100% of the sample nominated that it would be their mother that they would want with them. So it seems to me that young people want this communication and would feel protected by this communication. We have to ask mothers, what is it that is holding them back from this communication? We know that the life skills programs in schools are not explicit enough, are not direct enough, are not delivered by people with empathy and who young people can identify with. But I would say that young people, the younger generation, are open to be guided, but that guidance mustn't come in the form of what we were often told, which is stay away from boys, don't be a bad girl. These were sort of general moral injunctions. They weren't specifics about how conception happens, what one's menstrual cycle is, what contraception is. And we also know that in many, many clinics, staff are very unfriendly to young women wanting contraception. We have heard people say that they were told, what is this hotel between your legs? And sure, they were so humiliated by the comment that they didn't go back. So there is a massive communication problem. But I would say, I mean, I don't want to draw any conclusions from birth to 30 at the moment. These young people are only halfway through their lives. Everything can happen for them. If I had to conclude one thing, it would be that family is everything.
Well, everything can happen for them, but taking a look at, you know, the social and economic standing of where we are, and then muddled up the mental and social well-being of these young people, as the country stands currently, you know, they need to be resilient. And yes, definitely family is important, but resilience is more important for these young people. Where would they draw the strength from your study? Where are they drawing the strength from to be able to overcome the plethora of challenges that they're faced with?
Yeah, we held a webinar on Friday in which we talked about mental health issues and even suicide ideation. And I think many of the people who listened to that webinar would have been shocked that about 20% of young people think about suicide. And they think about it because life is extraordinarily challenging for them. They are naturally optimistic. That is a characteristic of their age, that they're naturally optimistic. But at the same time, they are aware of the enormous barriers that exist for them. As I said, if somebody doesn't have a matriculation certificate, it is hard to imagine that they can enter into the formal economy. They can pick up toch labor, they can work, do some temporary manual work, they can get a youth employment program job. But actually securing employment and being stable looks very far away from them. So yeah, there are enormous challenges. But if I had to look at the successes of people in the study who face the same difficulties, the common element is a granny, an aunt or mother who loved and believed in them almost regardless. And it's expressed in so many ways. We asked young people when they were about 12 what they would do if they won the lotto. And universally, Patricia, they said, I'd build my mother, my granny, or my aunt a house. There is a sense of, for many, many young people, it is this older generation of women, and that's what I'd be frightened of, is are we going to have another older generation of women who are going to be the stalwarts of our society, who are going to be sacrificing, doing domestic work and other routine hard work to support their children, get them through schools, believe in them, encourage them, and so on.
It is an intensive study, and one that does really bring light to where we are as a nation, because our young are the ones who are going to obviously take us, because we always say they are the future, but clearly there are a lot of elements that we still need to work towards. So are there any recommendations from the study, from you, around how the issues, especially those from the five major themes, like education and learning, growth and health, mental and social well-being, violence, social engagement, are there any recommendations that we need to be taking and moving forward to see a change?
Yeah. So we have concentrated a lot on recommendations in the early years of life, both for health and for well-being. So there are a lot of nutritional recommendations, for example, and some of our nutritional studies have really made a huge difference. You might remember the Madam and Eve cartoon series about the cotta. These young people are eating these kind of huge caloric overloads half a loaf of bread. With
Igoda, yes.
Exactly. So, that this is going to lead and increase the obesity epidemic that we are already seeing amongst young women in their 20s and 30s and 40s. So there are lots of recommendations about that, but there are also recommendations about strengthening families. And I'm personally quite disappointed in the development of family policy in South Africa to date. It's kind of focused on what I would consider quite superficial aspects of families. What has really helped are big policy shifts. So we are continually seeing refinements to policy that are really quite heartening. So we've just seen this change to incorporate families looking after orphaned family children. The child support grant being increased rather than having to go through courts to obtain a foster care grant. So giving financial security to families is one thing, but we have to start thinking of other things, things like childcare, for example. If more than 30 to 40% of women are economically active, whether in work but or outside the home, they might be selling mealies on the road out of a brazier, but they need childcare for their young children, where children are safe, secure, get fed properly, where their health is secured. We need to improve maternal health. So we're seeing too many babies in South Africa born of lower birth weight or born earlier than 40 weeks, which is the full term of a baby. So there are recommendations across this whole spectrum. Schools, I think, need to get on top of bullying, and there are good practice solutions in other countries. For example, teachers on duty during playtime, teachers on duty at the toilets, teachers on duty at the gates, where bullying episodes happen. So yes, there are lots of recommendations. Some of them are well known to stakeholders. It's a matter of prioritizing, addressing them. You know, we have a long list of things that have to be done. Currently, we're just trying to eliminate pit toilets in schools. And I hope we get that done quickly so we can get on to other priorities, particularly around violence, for example.
Well, those recommendations, let them be not just recommendations, but action points with the key deliverables from stakeholders, community, and departments that are keen to see a change in our communities. Thank you so very much, Professor Urechta, for joining us and sharing your study. The work that you're doing is exceptional, and I can't wait until you reach the age of 40 for this cohort of young people and tell us what they are doing then. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Patricia. Bye.